Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Get started on your painting project this summer and save big money at Menards. Rust-Oleum Stops Rust 5-in-1 Spray Paint lets you choose from 5 unique spray patterns with a twist of the dial, so you can get a professional, corrosion-resistant finish on every project. Save big money on Rust-Oleum Spray Paint now at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Anything to lose. I have no secrets to hide. I could just be blunt and people could judge it however they judge it.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning in to Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 15, Episode 5, The Crime Scene. This week, Bob dug into the crime scene reports and the autopsy, continuing to put the puzzle pieces together. This episode has raised a lot of questions, and Bob, Jant, and I are here to dive into them all. Before we get into that, do we have any housekeeping?
I don't think so. I just let you give you a little heads up what's coming this weekend. On Sunday, we're going to hear a lot from Jody. We talked about it a little bit in the pregame, but I've spoken with Jody 4 or 5 times. I said 4, but I think it was 5 times in the last 12 hours due to the 10 and 15 minute time limits. We're going to be breaking down an element of the case that shouldn't have been relevant, but was relevant. And they also got it completely wrong. And there's a crazy twist in it. So we're going to hear that on Sunday.
Whoa.
Nothing is normal in this case. Erica and I actually yesterday when we were working writing it, this case file is frustrating. It is really frustrating because it's just like nothing. Everything that should be there isn't there. We've discussed all that before. Do want to get right into the episode, though, because we have Angelique from episode 1 is actually coming out to the office today to discuss some things about her son Richard's case right after we're done recording this. So we need to get this thing done by 1 o'clock. So let's go. I'm going to go with Janet first because there was some, for those of you that don't know this, that are new to the season, Zach used to be a professional shooter, 3-gun shooter, competitive pistol gun type fella.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well said.
That's how words work. That's how it. Uh-huh. Yeah. And so we had some firearm related stuff in this episode that I want to talk to Zach about a little bit about. So before that, Janet, what'd you think?
I thought it was really interesting, continually frustrating. For me, it was very helpful after I listened to this episode a couple of times. I actually went back and listened to a couple of the earlier episodes, which feels like it's going to be happening a lot this season too. That became very important to me for the Pinyon Pines case because we were just covering so much and from so many different angles. So once I had listened to this episode a couple of times, I went back and listened to the DeMario episode, just trying to kind of remember, because you do throw back, you mention some things that we heard about in recent, in previous episodes. And it's one of those things where like, oh, okay, now this person's statement that we heard about a couple of episodes ago means something more or different to me. So I wanted to go back and listen to Victoria Miles' statements. I wanted to, you know, revisit the Candace thing, just sort of try to keep putting these pieces together, because as you say in the episode, there's so much missing and it's so confusing that it's hard to get a full picture because someone doesn't want us to have a full picture.
It certainly seems that way. And
that's how it feels.
And this is my first experience ever with any case we've ever done where I'm trying to put the pieces of the puzzle together around the crime scene without a single crime scene photo.
Yeah.
Like I'm reading, for those of you that went online to our website and were looking at the document, the case documents, Like the trial testimony, you read the trial testimony and they're referencing all these photos. For example, the little baggie of marijuana. Where was it? They said it's on the sidewalk. Is that the sidewalk, like out by the road?
Yeah.
Or is it the sidewalk path that leads from the front door to the road?
Right.
I don't know. And that's significant because, yeah. Because you know, it, especially let's say if they ever did any DNA testing on it and you found somebody's DNA on it. Well, that was, if it's out on the main sidewalk, then that sort of means the Victoria statement wouldn't be accurate, right? Like if that was someone connected to the crime, that means they fled out the front, not out the back. You know, there's just a whole lot going on there.
Yeah, but yeah. Truthfully, how much weight can we put into that? We have no true connection,
right?
That it's there. So I mean, it's really hard to put any weight. Even if they're DNA testing, if there's DNA testing and Jody's DNA comes back not on it, doesn't really show a lot because then we don't know where that baggie came from or when it got there.
Right. That's true. But we never know. So let's say that they test the DNA and it's Andrew Wayne Bell's DNA. On it.
Mm-hmm.
Now we've got a different story. Now, all of a sudden, the same person's DNA is on the baggie on the crime scene that's on the shell casings at the crime scene. You know what I mean? So it's I'm not suggesting that it's absolutely part of the crime, but it's just an unknown. And then it becomes an even bigger unknown, even if we had those results, because we don't know where the hell it was.
Yeah, I definitely have some questions of my own that we can sort of fold into the listener questions, anything that I didn't notice anybody else had said anything about. I don't know if you want to get into ballistic stuff with Zach now or just a general kind of how did he feel about the episode or what, but I'll sort of be done for now.
Okay, yeah, we'll just turn it over. Whatever you had thoughts about Zach before we get into the question.
Okay, so Sunday I took a bunch of notes on the episode. Listener Josh Beachy, who is also a competitive shooter, took a bunch of notes. We actually talked Monday and we had a lot of similar thoughts about a lot of this, which was interesting to me. We talk about the idea that it was a 45. In the episode, you discussed that it's a very uncommon weapon. I understand what you're saying. I don't think it's as uncommon as you think, especially in this scenario.
It's uncommon based on crime stats for inner city violent crimes.
So we're going to talk about price point, okay? You discuss 45 being expensive gun. There is a brand of gun called High Point. Josh brought up this. I had this immediately thought. There's a brand called High Point, which are very, very inexpensive guns. Comes in a 45 ACP. We jokingly call them a tactical brick because it's just a big, clunky gun.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of people in the inner city that purchase High Points because of the price point on them. Also, very cheap gun. The capacity on it's about 9 rounds, so it's listed.
Mm-hmm.
You can't typically get 9 rounds in that gun.
Yeah.
What you can get in that gun is 8 rounds.
Yeah.
Which is what I really thought about during the episode is when you were talking about the 8 shell casings, is that there's very ever likely that he didn't shoot until the person was dead. He shot until he was out of rounds.
Okay.
And then left.
I thought about that too, just from even other manufacturers of 45s, like even like a typical 1911.
Mm-hmm.
How many rounds does that hold?
6 to 9, depending on the gun. But 45 is a very large caliber, which means they're considered a single stack, which means they're all vertical, which means they don't fit as many in a gun.
Right.
So between 6 to 9 rounds, a lot of times, even if they're 9 rounds, you have to download them because the magazine spring, you just can't hardly get that 9th round in the gun.
Yeah.
And have it function. So, I mean, a lot of times you're in that 7 to 8 round range.
Yeah. So that is significant. I thought about the fact that you couldn't have a whole lot of rounds in there, more than probably 8 or 9.
Yeah.
But I hadn't thought about what you just mentioned, that one way or another, whether Mari was dead at that point or not,
they
would have been out of bullets, probably.
Yes, probably. A good chance that they're out of rounds, which is why they probably fled at that point.
Mm-hmm.
The other ballistic thing that we talked about in the episode was the silver casings. They brought up silver casings multiple times. Silver casings are steel or nickel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, steel-cased ammo, very cheap. It's the cheapest ammo you could possibly mm-hmm. find. Again, alludes to this. Nickel-cased ammunition is very expensive, and anybody that's using nickel is not going to commit a crime with it because of the price point.
Right.
Like, it's such a... So I'm tending to think that it was steel-cased ammunition, which is very easy to find in 45.
I don't know if you read through, because I don't think I mentioned the episode, but in the trial transcript, they mentioned when they were going through the collection of all the shell casings,
mm-hmm.
that there were steel ones, what they describe as gold ones also, which were brass. So there was a mixture.
Yeah. Okay. And it makes point. I mean, it makes sense. People just pick stuff up. I bought a 45 not too terribly long ago, and someone gave me ammunition with it, but it was literally like a loose baggie that had a bunch of different rounds. So, I mean, I could see how that happened. But that's what I was thinking when they kept saying silver. is steel cased, and steel case is extremely cheap ammo.
Right. But I think all that, and you'll be able to answer this, but it's relevant in my experience from what, because I've had a 45 and mm-hmm. 40 and a different calibers. And even the cheaper 45 ammo is typically more expensive than, it is more expensive than the cheaper 9mm ammo.
Correct.
For sure. Significantly.
Correct.
It's significantly more expensive than that.
So I think this is sheerly my opinion. This is nothing that I can put together. There's a lot of people that I think are ego related. And I think in a situation like this, 45 is a larger caliber. You feel more powerful. You feel like you mm-hmm. have that. That's why I think that truly, like, using a 45 in a crime like this is, it's someone with a little bit higher status. It's not someone using a 22 to commit a robbery. It's someone with a little bit higher status that wants that power, that wants to feel powerful, that wants to kind of show off that they have this large caliber gun. Higher level drug dealer, maybe.
Maybe. Yeah. And don't get me wrong. I think what I said in the episode, the way I put it in the episode is exactly how I mean about it. But it just struck me as odd. And I spent a ton of time researching this. Like, I stopped writing for a couple hours when I was doing all this research on it, because it just jumped out at me. I was like, wait a minute, 45. Because part of it is I just finished reading Jill Lavoie. Hopefully I get that author's name right off the top of my head. But the book Ghetto Side, that's all about inner city crime and violence. It's all through Los Angeles. But very, again, I've recommended before, amazing read. And they talked about the different guns they seize and all that stuff. So that's what sent me down that path. Like you had just mentioned a minute ago that it's common, it's very common for people in inner cities to buy those. Is that just anecdotal, or is that, because that's not what I found in my research at all?
From everything I've seen from working with people in that area, a lot of them carry high points.
Are we talking about?
These are clients of mine. These are friends of mine. These are people that I know that kind of live in that community.
Well, and so that kind of leans towards what I'm talking about, the kind of bifurcation there of it, because all of the stats are based on the people that are committing crimes in those areas. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if those are the people that you're talking about. You know what I mean? It seems like you're talking about people that are purchasing guns legally that happen to live in those areas.
Yes, but I still feel like those high points are out there a lot. I mean, like I said, I came up with it right away. Josh came up with it right away. That high point is a very low price point. You can get them at pawn shops. You can get them at gun stores pretty cheaply.
Right.
They're easy to, I mean, they could be passed around pretty cheaply. So I don't know. It's a thought that I had that I think is something to keep in mind.
And so when I was talking about the rarity of them, they're not super rare, but as far as like the actual manufacturer statistics, they're made in much smaller numbers, about a third of the numbers of like 9mm, like 45s in general, 9mm or 40 calibers or other more popular calibers. It was like 1 point some million compared to over 6 million of the others that are manufactured over a 20-year period or whatever. But the big thing was, like, through the Department of Justice and a lot of the statistics that I was reading, was when it showed like the types of guns used in crimes, period, not just inner city. In a lot of the charts, it was non-existent. Like it was such a small piece of the pie, it fell into the 1% others. Mm-hmm. And some of them, in certain studies, it would be they made up 2% of them. Overwhelming majority is the 22 revolver and then 9mm.
It makes perfect sense. We know for a fact that it's a 45 in this case.
Right.
So that's where I'm saying I think this is an egotistical buy, right? A 45 is a larger caliber.
Yeah.
It's something that they're trying to show power. It's pretty known in those cases that, like, that's what you're trying to do. There's several different calibers, and a 40 is like the one that you never hear of, right?
Yeah.
A 40 Smith, and the only reason they even stayed around as long is because the police used them for a long time. But like, they're dying off. That's a strange caliber for someone to own, truthfully. Right. So in a case like this, when I heard 45, it didn't surprise me, even though the statistics show a little different, just from the people that I know, kind of in a shadier culture, the 45 wasn't unheard of to me.
Yeah, I just want to quickly shout out Colin in the chat, who just wants to make sure we're kind of putting it in its place in time, which is to say, does it make a difference when we talk about the availability and stuff, that it was 23 years ago? I think it's good to just remember that, even if it doesn't change anything.
Yeah, and that's where I was looking at a lot of my statistics. I mentioned the one that was that 20-year span, like from I remember the 70s to the 90s. because that was the only one that I found that was like close to that range. The point being that these are all useful conversations to have, because the idea for me is once we like take this and if we hand it over to like Jim Clementi to like mm-hmm. profile it, that's something to consider. Kind of what you're saying, like in your mind, that means somebody with a higher status, something like that. And I think that's certainly reasonable. I also think it's reasonable that it could be maybe somebody that really hasn't been involved in too much crime, because a lot of this comes from the book from Ghetto Side and reading that, and then reading some articles about it. One of the reasons why the 22 caliber pistol revolver is so popular is for committing crimes like this is one, it's quiet, and two, it doesn't eject the shell, so it doesn't leave stuff behind. So it's actually a smart weapon to use for people that are doing stuff like that. Whereas the 45, as you know, that's a loud, as a hand cannon. Yeah. They're loud. They're real loud. And they, as we found in this case, they leave shell casings, you know, behind. So I think all those things will come into play. But I think it's a significant element, because we're lacking so many elements when it comes to profiling the scene, is we need to consider who would be using a 40. And it could be nothing, and not for nothing. I want to make clear, I don't think, because there were some discussions about this on Facebook, I don't think that a cop did this at all. I just want to make that clear. But one of the things that has been brought up is around that time, a lot of police departments went from 9mm to 45s, and then they phased out 45s around this time because of the cost. Because you got to remember, for a police officer to carry it, they have to go to the range all the time and shoot, and it's just the bullets are too expensive. And so they phase out, where now a lot of law enforcement, like you said, carries 40 calibers. Mm-hmm. They're more reasonable round to carry. So 45, another thing to consider. And again, I do want to be clear, I don't see any evidence here that this was a cop that did this. But another thing to factor in is a 45 was a gun around that time that a lot of law enforcement carried.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com. Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Josh posted essentially, I think, what you kind of recapped for us, Zach, as I know you said, sort of on behalf of you and Josh. So, Josh, thank you for posting that on the follow-up as well. And I'm so glad you guys had the chance to touch base about it and talk about it and help those of us who don't have as much ballistics knowledge as you guys have. So thank you for that. A couple of other gun follow-up questions while we're talking about it. Colin says, do you have a ballistics report? Were all the shell casings fired from the same gun? We just kind of touched on that, but for clarification.
Yeah, so we didn't get into that part of the trial testimony. I'll probably cover it at some point, but it's enough to put it here that the analysis was that came out of trial that was that all of the 45 rounds all came from the same gun.
So Crystal had also asked, are we sure that the bullets are from that night? No possibility. Some are pre-existing, like previous neighborhood goings on. That sort of answers that. Brian and Rebecca both asking questions about any records of a 45 caliber gun being used in any other crimes kind of contemporaneous to that, before or after the murder, and or Rebecca, any thefts of that kind of gun being reported?
All that stuff we're working on.
Great.
So it's like this just popped into my head while I was writing that episode. So now I'm working on trying to access some of that data.
Got it. And then Janaya is asking kind of what she calls the big question. And I get why she says that. She's asking about Andrew Wayne Bell. Do we know what kind of gun or bullets Andrew Wayne Bell used in his other crimes, if he used?
Well, one of his charges was definitely for carrying a concealed weapon. So I'm again, those are all answers we're trying to get right now.
Awesome. Let's move backwards in time just a second for anyone else who might just want this clarification again. Anne Margaret just wanted to revisit, knowing that we did talk about it in a past episode, but just verifying what the relationship was between Jody and the person they were allegedly with when they are being accused of trying to rob DeMario. Anne Margaret just isn't sure where that ended up, what became of that that person, and was he ever interviewed? And he asked who was with him at the time of the attempted robbery. My memory of past episodes is that he never said anyone. He did not identify the other person who was with him. But
that's actually going to be so Leon Newcomb was Jody's former foster brother. Mm-hmm. They lived in the same foster home at some point when they were very young. But that's actually going to be the subject of Sunday's episode.
Oh,
we're going to get into
cool.
Everything around that all that circumstance. So you get all those answers on Sunday.
Great. If I had known that, I would have saved it as the last question. Did not have that information. And apologies to all.
Yeah, so we end the episode here. So let's talk to you guys on Sunday.
No? Valeria has just a sort of organizational question that I'm just bringing up here in case other people are wondering about the same thing. As far as the way we see the case docs on the website for those folks who really take that time to review them, she's wondering if we could get like a spreadsheet that lists the documents and evidence and confirming the source, so that in a situation like this where the question is who had what access to what information during what part of the investigation or trial, like there are listeners who want to know, like, okay, this came from this place, which means that the prosecutor never saw it and the defense would have seen it. Like, I think people are looking to kind of get a better handle on that.
I mean, a lot of that stuff, we don't have time to do that. You know, I try to talk about where I try to, you know, give you the source of where stuff came from during the episodes. But a lot of it is unknown. So like the case file that was originally given to me came from an advocate and had been passed around all over the place. And then there's a mix match of stuff too, because I found out from Jody when I was talking to them last week that while they were in jail awaiting trial, a relative of theirs got a copy of some of the files. And I think that's where the original, like that's why the timesheet was in there, because in the original files that they were able to get while Jody was still in jail, the copy of the timesheet was in there. And then the timesheet, from what Jody's saying, when it got to, we talked a little bit about how they had an attorney, and then 10 days before trial, that attorney's taken off, a new one's put on, and there's a blitz to try to prep for this trial. That Jody actually had filed an appeal at one point that said, you know, that they were telling their attorney, like, hey, I have, because the attorney in the case file that they got from either the other attorney or from in discovery didn't have the timesheet in it. Jody says, and filed an appeal on that fact based on ineffective assistance of counsel, claiming that they had tried to give the attorney the timesheet that they had access to and that the attorney didn't end up using it or reviewing it or whatever. I don't know. We have no way of knowing if that's true or not. We do know that that was in the file somewhere. But then there's other stuff in there that I can't source, like, because it's all been mixed together over the years. So the Innocence Project at one point had the case and they pulled some files in. There's stuff that Jody had from prior to that, stuff that Jody got through FOIA while they were in prison. And of course, now then we have the BP, the Benton Harbor public safety file that they gave me, the little 137 page report on it, the murder book. And then I have now the prosecutor's file that has, you know, that is three times that size, that also is supposed to have the murder book in it. There's just a lot of questions. It's not super easy to source the stuff. I can tell you this came from the prosecutor and this came from the Benton Harbor Police Department file. Some of the old files, I don't know where they came from. And it's gone through too many hands for me to even really know about it. And that's some of the conversation I've been having with the attorney general about some of that stuff, or the CIU trying to source some of that stuff. So anyway, that was a long conversation. If somebody wants to pay attention to or ask me questions and create that spreadsheet, I'd be happy to put it up there. There's also been questions about how the documents are organized on the website. I'm doing something different this season. So in the past, every episode, I would make a folder for the episode and put those documents in it. And I would get a ton of complaints from people that, you know, 20 weeks into the season, they want to find the report on something and they don't know which episode it was in and they have to go through all these folders to find it all. So people were always asking me, can we just put them all out there so we can just scan through them? So I did that. And now, of course, I get emails from people saying, can you put them in the folders for the episodes? Because I can't. So I'm just putting them out there in there and just trying to label them in a way that they're easily recognizable and findable. So if somebody wants to look at the case in its entirety without going through a bunch of folders, they're able to do that.
Gotcha. Crystal, I saw your question in the chat. I did actually read through that, and I'm sorry that I bunched that in with some of the other gun questions, but just to revisit this really quickly. So Crystal just wants to make very sure that all of the bullets were from that night. No possibility some were pre-existing, like from a different event.
I mean, there was only two bullets recovered.
Yeah, so, and then the casings, same for the casings.
The casings that were recovered, the tool mark identification stuff, supposedly they all came from the same gun. The only two bullets were the one in the step, and then the one that went, it went through the step, and then was found in the storage area below, and then the one that was in the windowsill were the only two bullets, and those were also matched to the same gun.
Great. Carrie and Crystal are both wondering about the sort of status of the CIU, whether there are any updates, and also whether their involvement would preclude us from continuing the work that we're doing.
No, I mean, I don't have an official statement from them yet. It's not going to preclude us from doing the work that we're doing. I'll just say this. Over the years, I have worked with many attorneys, many innocence organizations, even conviction integrity units, and have always been able to navigate that process in a way that does not conflict with the work they're doing. And so we will continue along that process. So I guess just know I'm very conscious in how we proceed about how it may affect in the actual legal case going forward. That's the best I can give you right now.
Understood. Okay. Are we going to be talking more about the DNA?
It's not much more to talk about. I mean, one thing I did see, I don't know if it made your questions list, but somebody had pointed out that the verbiage in that report that I put out said like astringent association.
Yes, that's where I was going with that. Yeah.
So in that report, it says that they need to do more, you know, to get an actual blood draw and do more testing. There has been, I think, two other occasions of follow-up testing, and it was confirmed that that's who the DNA belonged to. There's not much more to talk about that. I mean, unfortunately, it's another instance. The biggest thing, the biggest hurdle that I'm seeing right now is now I have the prosecutor's file and I'm going through some of the appeals stuff. The biggest hurdle that Jody has is that they have filed so many appeals, some through lawyers, some pro se, some themselves. And anytime you do that, you just take away, you know, if you don't get it just right, you take away that opportunity. You can't relitigate that stuff from the defense side. If you file an appeal as, you know, on behalf of the defendant based on this DNA and it gets denied, you can't just go back and ask for them to look at it again. There has to be new evidence. In that case, I haven't read through that appeal yet, but from my understanding of it, from discussions that I've had, I think it was with Jody a while back, was essentially they said, well, here we have the DNA of the person whose DNA is on these shell casings. And the court basically ruled, well, all that proves, or it was argued by the state, and I think the court ruled, well, that just proves who loaded the gun. It doesn't prove who shot the gun. And it was left. And Jody has not had particularly great attorneys, great help as far as defense goes in the appeals, because that should have been, I think, been able to be argued much better than that. For like, just from what I'm seeing as a non-lawyer, the entirety of the, which we haven't got to yet, but the state's closing argument hammer home how there's a single shooter, one person, single shooter, one person, single shooter. And they're like, hey, we have the DNA on the shell casings. They're like, wow, that just shows that maybe their accomplice loaded the gun. It's like, what? And by the way, to answer any follow-up question, there's no connection between Jody and Andrew Wayne Bell. No one has ever made that. No, there's no connection to Jody and a 45 caliber pistol. There's no connection to Jody and Andrew Wayne Bell at all.
Is there a connection between DeMario and Andrew?
I don't know. But I think what should have to happen is, now that you have this new information, is now, in order for this to maintain the integrity of this conviction, in my opinion, you have to show there's a okay, if this person loaded the gun, then you have to now show me how is that person and the convicted person connected.
Right.
And that wasn't done. But that's going to be a hurdle because it's already been litigated. not in a great way, but it was litigated. So it's not new evidence anymore. That's why like the Innocence Project has turned away Jody's case. It's not because they don't think they're innocent. It's not because there's not overwhelming evidence. It's because the path forward to litigate this get limited because of all the previous appeals that have been done on it when they weren't fully prepared. And you can think about that when we go back to some of the other cases, when, you know, think about Adnan's case and other, I think we talked about some of it in the Pinion Pines case about, well, why aren't we filing for this right now, filing for this right now? And you've heard me say in cases in the past, because you get one bite at the apple. So you need to make sure that you have all of your ducks in a row. You have everything together because you get one crack at it to put it in. And this is one of those cases where they were in the early days of the appeal, they were kind of throwing things against the wall and just to see what would stick, trying to and piecemealed all this stuff together. When I think if you look at it in its entirety, if you'd filed that all as one big package, it probably would have overturned the conviction. That being said, I'll just tell you that I'm still very, very confident this conviction gets overturned. So don't be disparaged by what I'm saying, but it's a hurdle.
Yeah. Just to draw a circle around this for my own anger sake, well, let's talk about Cotter for a second. So Cotter's a prosecutor, right?
Right. Judge now.
Let me just take a moment for that. Great. That's great information. So we see all of this, what really appears to be very careful, kind of fancy footwork, as you describe it, I think, around making sure that certain pieces of information are just sort of skipped over or omitted or buried, just in terms of the trial alone. Like what you say about, you know, when you have someone on the witness stand and you say, did there come a time when, but you don't ask what that time was.
Right.
Knowing that the DNA did not match Jody. So we're basically saying, like, Cotter knew. I mean, if this is a situation where you have all of this information and you're being that careful, it sure seems like the prosecutor in this case didn't care that they were prosecuting the wrong person.
I mean, that sadly, that's the case in so many of the, the cases that we do, right? As David Dobbs said back in season two. When I get into when the case gets ready to go to trial, my goal is to win.
Yeah.
Like that's my job is to win once we get there. And I think that that's what we saw here. But yeah, I just didn't want to make, and you didn't imply this, but just to make crystal clear, they did not have Andrew Wayne Bell's identification on the DNA until after trial.
Right. But they certainly knew it wasn't Jody.
Yeah. They did know. And that did come out. Like it came out that but it was just brushed aside because it was, you know, like I said, they argued it could have been the manufacturer.
But give me a break. You know what I mean? Give me a break.
Exactly.
Give me a break.
I think that's the best way to put it.
Ugh.
Give me a break with that.
Yeah. You know? And I think what's upsetting about it is, again, it's one thing when you feel like someone is not given all of the information and so they move forward, you know, but it is up to the DA's office to say, yes, we have enough to prosecute. We're going to go ahead and prosecute on this.
Right.
And then there have to be these conversations that are happening when there's missing material or issues with what time the crime happened. It's really hard not to imagine conversations happening between the officers involved and the attorney where they say, hey, we have a problem with this. Hey, this might come up. We need to talk about this and get out in front of it, which that in and of itself is conspiracy. Like that is conspiracy. So for people who say there's no conspiracy, it's like there has to be a conspiracy just for an attorney for the DA's office to say, hey, this is going to be a problem. And for the police to say, well, here's how you can explain that. Or they have to figure out how to deal with it.
Well, and then we don't know how much gray area is there either, right? So we don't know what was passed between McGinnis and Cotter. Clearly, Cotter knew, for example, in my opinion, it seems very clear that Cotter knew there was a problem with the timing. Because... Yeah. They take such great efforts with every single witness to dance around the timing. So they knew there was a problem there. But I don't know if they knew how bad the timing situation was, because I don't know what McGinnis told them. Because you can wind this all the way back to where we'd like to start our frustrations when the murder happens on Thursday night and they know right then. They know, as McKinney says in his report, that he was called to the scene at midnight. Right. They know that it happened before midnight. And then the next morning they go to Dialo's and ask Sean, you know, had they seen Jody? And he's like, well, we were here late last night till, you know, like I said, he doesn't remember exactly the time, but telling them we were here till past midnight, wherever. The timesheet's right there. Like, from that, that's what drives me crazy. From that moment, they knew they were after the wrong person. From that moment. And all of this transpired after that.
Ugh, what a mess. Well, just to touch on McKinney for a second, and you may not have a more elaborate response than you just mentioned in the episode, just to come back to his report and saying that the address was on Pavone and not Broadway, and that no one lived in the downstairs apartment. Like, what do you make any more of that than what you mentioned in the episode? I mean, you basically say, like, I think you essentially say, I don't know if this is incompetence or if it's something more nefarious, but what the hell?
Obviously, we're guessing, right? But writing 784 Pavone instead of 784 Broadway, like, I just imagine that's just a mental mistake.
Is Pavone the connected street?
It's parallel. It's right behind.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, it's behind parallel. It. It's not a intersection. It's just a different. It's
yeah. They're,
okay.
Pavone and Broadway run parallel to each other. They're the next street over.
Gotcha.
So I would imagine, because he says 784 Broadway through the rest of it, it's just like in that one spot.
Got it. Got it.
That seems like a mistake. But saying that there was no one occupying the downstairs apartment.
But then they lean on her. That's their key.
Later, like, right? And that, like to me, that seems so intentional, because what we hear, because you get whiffs of in the later reports about Sonia Lucas, is where they say in her original statement she said da 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 da, and I mentioned last week, I'm like, well, where is it?
Yeah,
like, where is her original statement? She told me that they came in, they searched her house, they took a statement from her. They took a statement from her stepfather, who I learned that from not only her, but also Jody, because in that packet of file in papers that Jody had gotten way back when, because now this is what Jody's telling me. I have no way to verify this because they don't have those documents anymore. But Jody says when they originally got the paperwork from the ongoing investigation, there was an interview statement from Sonia and there was an interview statement from her stepfather, confirming the same thing, that they never opened the door until after the cops got there. Then, all of a sudden, months later, we get this news story about the dying declaration, and now there's reference to there was an original statement, no reference to the stepfather's statement at all, and we don't have the statement. Then you see that when McKinney wrote the report back then, prior to getting that statement from Sonia, so at the time when McKinney's report was written, the one in the original murder book, at the time that was written, all they had from Sonia Lucas was nothing, right? She heard the shots, came out, and so she's disappeared from the file. Nobody even lives there, right? She's gone. But then later they get her to give this whole statement, and now it's back. Now the original statement, which we don't have a copy of, is back. That just seems extremely intentional to me. And what seems absolutely intentional to me is when you read McKinney's report, and I put up on
the side-by-side is kind of chilling to look at.
Yeah, the two, the original McKinney's original report, and then the version that the prosecutor had, were the entire section that discusses interviewing of Victoria Miles and all of McKinney's investigative steps that he did. And Wendell Moss mentioned this on the Facebook page too. It's like, it makes sense how they're trying to, part of the timing issue, right? Because McKinney did all this before McGinnis got there. All this stuff, interviewing Victoria Miles, the investigative steps they left in there. Well, that really messes up their timeline if we know at 12:51 they get a hold of McGinnis. So in the copy that goes to the prosecutor, that entire section is just disappeared. And you can see it in the side-by-side. It literally is just deleted out of there like it never happened. That's intentional. There's no way that's
an accident. What I would love to hear from a police officer, like, no, there's a very honest, reasonable explanation for that. I can tell you exactly what it is. I would love to hear that.
I don't think you're going to.
I mean, I imagine you're right. Let's quickly circle back to the downward angle, because that is definitely something that I think has confused people and is causing confusion around. Richard, I saw your comment in the chat. Crystal, Monica, I know that you had some questions about that in Facebook as well. I think that's part of why all of the question about could it have been from a different event is bubbling around. Could you walk us through the downward angle of one of the shots and help us understand that that doesn't necessarily mean someone was on the top floor? It wasn't like the person, Victoria Miles did it because she was above the DeMar.
Yeah, it absolutely doesn't. You got to listen to the whole thing. The bullet hole was in the fascia, in the lip of the step, in the lip of the front of the step. It was just at a slightly downward angle. So the shot came from down the stairs. It just, but
so yeah, you have to. I mean, easy way to break it down. Stairs are about 7 inches. Okay. So 9 stairs, about 5 feet in the air. So you could be easily standing on the second stair and hit the 9th stair on a downward angle.
Yeah. And those vary. It depends on the construction.
Well, but I mean, just a.
Yeah. So basically, yeah, if you're standing on the little landing, the 9th step is probably eye level or a little bit below eye level. So you take 1 or 2 steps up and shoot down at somebody probably laying on the steps, then it's going in at a downward angle. So it was not, for those of you that are watching on video, so like if this is the step, and so this is downstairs, the shot didn't come down at an angle like that. It came down at an angle like this, at a slight downward angle in the front of the step. So yeah, that shot did not come from above. It came from below.
Okay. And it still works that it wouldn't have to have been from a different event either. That being said, Richard, I saw your comment, and then Lynn on the Facebook page says, is it common practice to swab multiple shell casings with one Q-tip? I guess I could see separate swabs, but only running DNA testing on one to save money. Is this contamination? Is this a potential contamination? How can we even know for sure that everything came from the same thing if it was all being used with the same swab?
Yeah, I don't know. It seems odd to me that they did it that way. I think that part of what played into that is that it was determined that the casings were all fired from the same gun. So they're like, well, let's just take a swab from it. Because you have to get, people are like, you have to get a certain volume of DNA to get a profile. So I think that probably is why they, I don't know. I'm not a DNA expert, why they did it that way. The fact that the DNA, it comes back to a person with a known criminal record that, and by the way, where they were arrested, where Bell was arrested in February of that year was just a couple blocks away. It was right down the street where it happened. So like the whole idea of maybe this is from a manufacturer, maybe there's some explanation. I wish they had done it differently. I wish we'd know from each different round, but the result would be the same for me in practical terms. So if they found Andrew Bell's DNA on 2 of the casings, but not 4 of the other ones, it doesn't change anything to me. They were all loaded into the same gun and fired out of the same gun. Sometimes you leave more. Zach was just talking about because of the spring in the magazines, it's hard to push those, which is why you end up with so much DNA on those rounds because they're hard to push in there. You know, it could be one was more, you know, the first couple you popped in real easy, and then the last ones you drag more skin cells off them. So I don't think it really practically matters. What we know is we have a DNA of a person, of a convicted felon that committed crimes with guns right down the street. Their DNA is also on these shell casings. That's what we know.
Well, and I would also add, and look, I don't know. I'm not a crime scene investigator or anything like that. But in terms of returning to the idea of whether it was a hit or not, if you are planning a hit, the idea that you use your own hands to load your gun and then you go to a place knowing that you're going to kill someone and knowing that your fingerprints are all over the casings and you don't pick up the casing. You know what I'm saying? Like that also a little bit, I think, contributes to the idea of like, this was not a planned hit. Like this is a clean situation where someone showed up planning to end this person's life and get away with it. Like this doesn't read like that also because leaving all your breath, you know.
Yeah, and also if that's your intention, I don't think you go stand outside in an open lot 100%. And have a 10-minute argument with them before you do it.
Exactly.
We're also looking at this in a lot of hindsight and thinking there's a lot of criminal sophistication here too. You have to think that not every criminal is a super sophisticated criminal that's going to put this much thought into, oh, I can't touch this. Oh, I need to pick up the shell casings. Oh, I need to, like...
Well, but that's what we're trying to determine, right? Is what is the level of criminal sophistication?
Exactly.
Right?
Correct. But we can't just assume that, like, that's the reason.
No, I guess I think we're saying the same thing in different ways. But, like,
yeah.
No, what I'm looking at it is I'm using all this data to come in so I can later start to think about, okay, what it was in the mindset of the person. Were they thinking like a very sophisticated criminal that's policing their brass and all that? Or were they, you know, was it somebody that just wasn't thinking like that because they weren't that sophisticated? So that's kind of like what I'm trying to figure out.
Right.
I'm sorry, before you get into that, I have to pause for for 1 minute and four seconds.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
With a $5 meal deal with new McValue, you pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
We, as like true crime fans, think everything is this super sophisticated, super laid out. These people put a lot of thought into these crimes, you know, this like, this is a hit, we're going to cover all this up. And I think a lot of times we forget that, like, I don't want to say it's a crime of passion, but like, it's just a crime of incident. And I don't think a lot of these criminals necessarily think to the point of like, I need to pick up my brass, especially if you're shooting a 45, that is super fucking loud. I mean, super loud, that the moment you fire, you're going to want to get away because people are coming. So I don't think that you're going to...
Or you don't care because you're in a community where it doesn't matter because you don't trust the police to come and do their jobs. At this point, like, why would you even think that anything's going to happen? I mean, if
that's... No, absolutely right.
If that's an environment, it's like, it doesn't matter whether my fingerprint's on it. It doesn't matter if I'm carrying this gun for a reason and I'm going to use it for a similar reason and I'm not worried about what the cops are going to do. And also, you know, the whole community and, like, value of life and expectation of maybe serving time anyway. I mean, I think all of that, you're so right, Zach, is like rolled up into how we look at a crime scene versus what it's like to live in a community where all bets are off in many of those ways, right?
Yeah.
Bob, just say good point.
Yeah, so it seems like you did not pause.
Erica, it's work. Well, we didn't really necessarily mean to, but then we ended up, I think, saying something that is kind of valuable.
Are we getting close to the end?
Yeah. So just really quickly, a question about the environment. Like, people were wondering, you know, is because we don't have those crime scene pictures, you may not have this information either. We have the diagrams that give sort of a sense of where things are in relation to other things. But is there, people are wondering, is there a reason that he went into the building versus out into the woods or into a different building? Like, is there a significance to choosing that building? Why would that front door have been open? If it's just a two-person space, would that outer door maybe have, you know, typically had a lock on it or any information like that you might have?
I don't know. I mean, Zach brought this up a long time ago, a few weeks ago, about what, you know, the fact that DeMario ran into the building instead of running away. Yeah. I mean, obviously, we don't know from DeMario because he's gone. And we just don't, and we don't know the exact layout of how things were. I think we do know, I did see some questions. We do know that Mario was friends with the Miles that lived upstairs. And then also Sonia that lived downstairs knew him too. So, you know, he knew the people that lived there. Seems like that front door was usually left open. And then the doors into the actual two units was what was kept locked. So I don't know. I mean, it's kind of like what we were just talking about with the gun as far as planning. Like, we can't really put too much into, I think, why he went into the building as somewhere else, because and you're in a moment of panic and someone is shooting at you and somebody's actually shooting you. Like, who knows? I think you're just trying to, you're trying to run from your life one way or another. In this instant, that door looked like a place to go for safety. In another instance or another person running across the street might have been the place to go for safety. We also don't even know how many, that's getting into more. We don't even know how many people were there. Okay.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
We don't even know if it was just one shooter.
Right.
Based on some other witness statements. So it's just hard to know. But to answer the question that I did see some people ask, yes, Mario had a relationship with the people in both units.
Gotcha. So,
can I ask a quick question? I didn't see it listed anywhere. It's about the placement of Mario. In the episode, you saw several times that there's witnesses that say his arm was hanging out the door. I mean, are they sure it was his arm? Could it have been a leg or a foot?
Maybe. It's hard to say. All I have, again, is just because I don't have any pictures. Mm-hmm. So all I have is these witness statements. I think there was two different people that said we looked, you know, the shots were over and we looked across and the door was propped open a little bit and we could see an arm hanging out of the door. Maybe it was a foot. I don't, because the way the door swung, if it's a foot, then it doesn't add up to me.
Okay.
How the head could be the way that Takamoto described the head.
Yeah.
You know, how could his head be over here and his body this way and a door swinging this way and then his foot's out the door? You know, it's I don't know. Again, a crime scene photo would be fabulous.
Well, I mean, it's even the door, right? Three quarters of the way open seems very subjective to figure out what that means.
Yeah, to me, that means almost all the way open.
Yeah.
Right.
But the neighbors across the street are like, yeah, the door was propped open a little and his arm was hanging out of it.
Yeah.
Which is, if you looked at the diagram, the stairs are right there to the right. Makes sense to me if you like kind of stumbled back down the stairs and just ended up right there in the door. But then also, like, there's all these dynamics that we usually like to do in a crime scene reconstruction that we can't do because we don't have any fucking pictures. Right? So think about that.
Mm-hmm.
What if they're right, right? What if he had come down the stairs and his arm is hanging out of the door? Think about timing of that. The offender's fleeing, but Mario's arm gets to the door before the door closes. Right? So Mario shot at, you know, nine steps up. The offender's fleeing and Mario either falls or whatever down the stairs. There's a timing issue. Was there a closer on the door? Did it automatically close? Did they have to close it? Mm. But, you know, there's all these questions that could help us piece together what actually happened there. We just have all these giant black holes of information.
Yeah, just to touch on that quickly, and then we have like maybe one more. But so Victoria Miles, I know that there's maybe a little bit of question about what she actually could have seen because of the plastic over the window, her description of a very tall, slim person leaving. She's also the one, right, who says that another car pulls up, a small, darker car, like a hatchback or something. Do you remember this? That
the hatchback was Mario's.
Okay, sorry. I thought that she said there was an existing car with the trunk open. That was Mario. And then another car pulls up.
Yeah. She said that a car pulled up in the alley behind.
Right. Okay. And so then they're talking.
Killer walked out of that
right.
to the front, talked to Mario.
And they have a conversation. What is there a description about which, like, does anyone have, no one says, and then the person we heard footsteps running away, or the car then started up again and drove away. Like, isn't there any kind of post-shooting?
That's a whole episode. But Victoria did say in that original statement that she saw through her side window, through the plastic, the shadow of a person going back to where the car was in the alley and then leaving. Uh-huh. And then there's other witnesses that come out later that say they heard a car squeal out. There's a whole thing with the car.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole thing with the car.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. And shockingly, those stories change too.
Well. Just going to finish out with Garrett today, who said, did the police reports confirm that Mario's truck was open or closed? If open, did they even consider that something might be missing from there?
It was confirmed by all the officers that the trunk was open and the car was running. Now, again, a crime scene photo would be great here because people say that, that Mario was sitting out there by himself listening to music. And at some point, he opened the trunk, and he had the trunk propped open, I think, with like a stick. Like it didn't, it must have been the shocks didn't work, didn't stay up. But so then kind of the assumption is, oh, he must have opened the trunk because he had a big speaker back there that was thumping music. I've kind of thought that's what I pictured in my mind, too. But then it occurred to me, too, that it's midnight. Like, is he out there blasting music, pumping, or has he just got some music playing in his car, which then comes back to, why is the trunk open? And that was kind of the point I was making. Like they leaned on the idea that there was no robbery. Robbery wasn't the motive because he had $81 in his pocket and a cheap silver necklace. So clearly it wasn't robbery. But what I mentioned earlier and what I was implying in this episode is we don't know what was in that trunk.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah.
Like why was the trunk open? Is the hatchback open and there's nothing back there? Well, that. Mm-hmm. That would indicate to me that there probably was something back there, probably had something to do with why they were meeting there to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
I still maintain it's going to take a lot to convince me that Mario didn't drop Canvas off to go to that place to meet someone. And then, as I mentioned in the episode 2, the whole thing about the cell phone. Like, why do we have a report that they returned Mario's cell phone to Rolanda, but we have no report about what they found from the cell phone?
Yeah, that's pretty glaring.
And by the way you painted the picture, where the shell casings are on next to Mario's car, I think the altercation started at the trunk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Truthfully, I mean.
You were probably able to track. I was hoping people would be able to track that. I still want to try to put it. But, and you would know, about how far do you think a shell will, I know it's different.
Every firearm is different, but I mean 5 to 10 feet.
Yeah, not
very far. Depending, not super far.
Yeah, and so, again, if you're on the video, it's like if this is the car and this is the trunk and this is Broadway, the shell casings are found over here to the right, which would indicate to me they're probably aiming the gun this way. Like Mario, they're right there at the trunk, right near the back of the trunk for the shell casing to eject onto the other side of the car.
Mm-hmm.
I know I said I was done, but I did want to just quickly hit on Emmett's, because Emmett's an EMT, but he found it a little bit odd that the medic didn't seem to make any attempt to resuscitate Mario. Just thought it was a little strange that there was no, like, he didn't seem like he checked for a rhythm, that it was just sort of like, I got there and observed that he was deceased.
Yeah, I had you said Emmett was that person?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Emmett, I had the same as a former EMT myself. That was so frustrating to read the testimony. The only question that was asked was, did you attempt to resuscitate? No. Well, that's not the only question.
Right.
Did you examine the body? Did you move the body? Because generally, in order for the way this works for those who don't know, at least here in Berrien County, is in order to not perform life-saving measures on someone, you have to get approval from medical control. Like, you have to get on the phone and tell them what you have in front of them. You know, so we'd have scenes where we get called to a full arrest and you show up and the person is blue and stiff. You know, then we would have to call and say, they've been down for a long time, body's stiff, and they're like, okay, you can call it. That's it. Even then, still, we have to, you call it running a tape on them. You put an EKG on them and run a strip, which is what Emmett was referring to, just to show it's flatline. You know,
and so, you would take a shirt off or lift a shirt up to do that, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I do not picture a scene where the EMT just looks at him and goes, yep, they're dead. That's not how it works.
Yeah.
There was more actions that were taken there, but they were not, they weren't asked about them at trial. And of course, the medical report, the EMS report is not in the file either. The EMS report that would have the run times on it.
All right, so that's what we've got. There was a lot to cover, and really interested in what we're going to be hearing more about next week.
Yep, and as I mentioned, you're going to hear from Jody. We're going to be talking a lot about the robbery and Leon. That whole situation is coming up on Sunday. Somebody did ask, and Crystal in the Facebook page had asked about the murder from episode one. As I mentioned earlier, we got to go right now because Angelique is on her way to the office right now for us to do some work on that. So we're going to be doing that, and we'll talk to you guys next week.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music for Season 15 is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weber. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. Doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Thanks for selling your car to Carvana. Here's your check.
Whoa, when did I get here?
What do you mean?
I swear it was just moments ago that I accepted a great offer from Carvana online. I must have time traveled to the future.
It was just moments ago. We do same day pickup. Here's your check for that great offer.
It is the future.
It's the present and just the convenience of Carvana. Sorry to blow your mind.
It's all good. Happens all the time.
Sell your car the convenient way to
Carvana.
Pickup times may vary and fees may apply.